from Iowa Public Radio News, this is a mini-series called The Procrastinator's Politics.
I just want to emphasize the degree to which we are in serious times, and this is a really serious one. This is not entertainment.
They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. And some, I assume, are correct.
We cannot sit back and hope that everything works out for the best.
Promising another Obama.
Of the United States. Get out and vote.
Hey, procrastinators. Hopefully you know this already, but Election Day is November 8th. And actually, I have already voted. I'll be peacing out from this election because this week will be our last episode. But there's one thing I really want to mention just from my experiences at the polls. It's a friendly reminder. Turn your ballot over. There might be some names you won't recognize, and maybe you'll be tempted to skip those offices, but please, please don't omit your vote on Iowa's state Supreme Court judges. If you've heard about any Supreme Court in the news thus far, it's probably been about the U.S. Supreme Court, which has been an Iowa issue because of Republican Senator Charles Grassley, who's the head of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and he's been helping to block President Obama's nominee, so the extremely crucial decision of who will be our next U.S. Supreme Court judge will be up to the next president. People have made a big deal out of it because it is a big deal. The courts in general are a big deal. The Supreme Court in Iowa determines whether or not the laws that we've made in this state are legitimate. Iowa's Supreme Court has been responsible for decisions made on things like whether or not school districts can be sued for sexual assault cases, whether or not undocumented immigrants can work in Iowa under President Obama's executive order. What the reach of state agencies like the Department of Transportation should be. And in 2009, the Iowa Supreme Court made the ultimate call that legalized gay marriage. Today, three of the judges from that case are up for retention. Justice Mark Cady, Justice Daryl Hecht, and Justice Brent Apple. So when you get your ballot, you'll see that under each judge's name, there's an option of yes or no. Because you see, here in Iowa, we don't vote judges in. They're appointed by our current governor, and we affirm whether or not they get to stay. So you get to choose who gets a seat and who has to leave. And actually, that's something that Iowans should really be proud of. In other states, you might be subject to people campaigning to get onto the highest court in the state, which means you might hear advertisements like this from North Carolina court candidate Bob Edmonds.
A former prosecutor, Edmonds has thrown the book at predators, refusing to let them use loopholes, instead locking them up and keeping them off the internet and streets.
So next week, when you're standing in the voting booth, shaking with excitement that you got to participate in the electoral process and feeling empowered because America, don't forget to turn the ballot over. I'm Shirley Wong. You're listening to The Procrastinator's Politics for the last time, at least for the next 4 years. Let's return to the news from last week. Our first story, as Iowans prepare to cast their ballots next week, the race is on for the control of Iowa's Senate, where Democrats have a slim 26-24 majority. If Republicans take enough seat to win the majority, it will mean the GOP will be in charge of both houses of the legislature and the governor's office for the first time since the 1996 election. Republican Party of Iowa Chair Jeff Kaufman says the two parties are competing hard in competitive districts across the state.
We all knew that the Iowa Senate was going to be ground zero. I mean, we all knew that there were going to be multiple battlegrounds throughout the state. That's exactly what it's shaping up to be. I feel very good right now on the Republican chances to take over.
This is the third election where Senate Democrats defended a 26-24 majority. Democratic Senate Majority Leader Mike Gronstal says he is cautiously optimistic his party will retain their slim lead, just as they did in 2012 and 2014.
In some respects, it's not much different from the last three cycles. In each of those cycles, Republicans said, hey, we're going to get the Iowa Senate. Each of those cycles, they did not succeed in that. It is an interesting political year.
The two parties are spending millions of dollars on a handful of competitive races where Republicans believe they can knock off incumbent Democrats. In other news, a woman has been arrested in Des Moines for allegedly voting twice. Terry Rote is charged with election misconduct in the first degree, which is a Class D felony. Polk County Attorney John Sarcone says he's only seen this type of crime maybe three times in the last quarter century.
People aren't voting more than once. And if they do or attempt to do it, they will get caught because there are safeguards in place. We want everybody to exercise their right to vote, but only once.
Sarcone says the rarity of voter fraud shows that Iowa's election system is secure. Rote was released Friday on a $5,000 bond. If convicted, she faces up to 5 years in prison. And Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump told a large crowd of supporters in a Cedar Rapids amphitheater on Friday night that he hoped justice would be served now that the FBI is reviewing new emails related to Hillary Clinton's private server. His latest Iowa campaign stop also included promises to repeal Obamacare and protect family farms from what he says are Clinton's plans to sharply increase taxes.
Adding to the pain, Hillary wants to substantially increase the estate tax on family farms. In other words, it will be very hard to leave your farm to your children and your heirs.
Clinton has proposed raising the estate tax to 50% for estates worth more than $10 million. An Iowa State University report this month says that very few family farms would be subject to estate tax liability if Clinton's proposal is enacted. Speaking of Hillary Clinton, the Democratic presidential candidate spent most of Friday in Iowa at two rallies billed as Women Win. In Cedar Rapids, she made a pitch for early voting. Clinton urged the crowd to compare and contrast her with Republican rival Donald Trump.
Think about every single concern you've got. Think about your kids and your grandkids and what you'll tell them about how you voted. Because I want you to join me in voting for a better America.
Clinton did not comment about the news that the FBI is examining a new batch of emails from her time as Secretary of State. She made a late afternoon stop in Des Moines. Mike Pence, the running mate of GOP presidential nominee Donald Trump, returned to Iowa Tuesday afternoon, stumping at a rally in Fort Dodge. Iowa Public Radio's Sarah Bowden reports.
Before a crowd of approximately 300 people, Pence said Trump's ability to give voice to the aspirations and frustrations of the American people is similar to that of President Ronald Reagan. The Republican VP nominee went on to discuss plans for the first 100 days of a Trump-Pence administration.
So we're going to sign a moratorium on any new federal regulation on day one, and Donald Trump and I are going to repeal every single Obama executive order that was signed into law that's stifling jobs and growth in this economy.
Pence has visited Iowa several times this month. Today, Trump and Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton will be in Iowa. A recent poll shows the two neck and neck. I'm Sarah Bowden, Iowa Public Radio News.
At the Branstad administration's weekly news conference, Lieutenant Governor Kim Reynolds was asked about the reports of sexual harassment and assault against Trump.
It's inexcusable, unacceptable, and you know that that's what I feel. But there's a lot of misinformation out in this election. There's a lot of other issues, and I just think we need to put some of these aside, and we need to focus on the direction that we want to take this country.
Reynolds urges Iowans to, in her own words, ignore the clutter and distraction when they vote. Polls show Trump with a narrow lead over Hillary Clinton among likely Iowa voters. In his final debate with Republican Congressman David Young, Democratic challenger Jim Maurer was asked about rising premiums for policies that are sold through insurance exchanges created by Obamacare. Here's another story from Iowa Public Radio's Sarah Bowden.
In explaining his support of Obamacare, Maurer highlighted the fact insurance companies can no longer reject people with pre-existing conditions and that more than 90% of Americans are now insured. But the candidate didn't offer many specific policy solutions on how to keep premiums and other health care costs low.
Well, when you look at the relicensing requirements that are placed on physicians, you looked at the Cadillac tax, the taxes that are placed on folks who have health insurance that is deemed to be too generous in some cases. I disagree with those things.
Young has voted to repeal Obamacare. He says instead people should have health savings accounts and be able to buy policies across state lines. I'm Sarah Bowden, Iowa Public Radio News.
Continuing with our coverage of Iowa's congressional district races, we've got our story on the 4th Congressional District. It covers the Northwest and much of the North Central part of the state. It's the largest and most conservative, with 38% of registered voters Republicans. That hasn't stopped Democrat Kim Weaver from launching a campaign to unseat incumbent Steve King. Iowa Public Radio's Amy Mayer reports.
Florida, it's the biggest by far.
39 counties.
Do you have a map in your district?
I have one on my phone.
Candidate Kim Weaver shows a map of the 4th to California Congressman Eric Swalwell, who was born in the district. He came through to campaign with her earlier this month. Swalwell says Weaver is someone he'd like to work with.
And I want a colleague like Kim in Congress because we need more hands toiling away to lift so many students out of student loan debt.
Weaver's made student loan debt a key part of her platform. She has three adult children shouldering college debt. At this gathering in Ames, she explains her program to help people earn credit against that debt.
So what I would like to do is propose a program, I'm calling it iGive, generating investment through volunteer engagement.
Weaver says borrowers would dedicate 4 hours a week to community service. In exchange, interest and payments are deferred, and at the end of a year, a portion of the debt is forgiven. Community members who need help with chores, such as laundry or grocery shopping, would be potential beneficiaries of the volunteer time. Weaver says her work as an ombudsman for residents in assisted living or nursing homes helped her come up with the plan. A resident of Sheldon, Weaver is a Democrat in a district where just a quarter of voters register with her party. Currently, the 4th is represented by one of the most conservative members of the U.S. House.
My job is to be the conscience of the constitutional conservatives in Congress.
That's Steve King talking with Republican Party loyalists in Nevada. He told them from his perch far on the right, he can debate the most left-leaning Democrats, such as Florida Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz.
When we debate and when we argue, the people in the middle have a chance to listen to her argument and mine, and then they can make up their minds. And it helps us get to a resolution, whether or not either one of us support that resolution.
King says he's spent years under a Democratic president and before that in a Democratic-controlled House pushing an agenda that hasn't gone far. But he says it's what his constituents want. For that reason, he's declined to debate Weaver.
Well, I thought it through, and I couldn't come up with a single reason to debate.
King says people know where he stands and wouldn't learn anything new from him in a debate. But Weaver, who competed in speech as an Iowa State University student, has her own ideas about his reluctance to debate.
I can think of several reasons, because maybe I'm articulate, intelligent, have good ideas. He might risk looking like a fool.
ISU political scientist David Peterson says the reality of the race is that King doesn't have to campaign.
He's got name recognition. He won with 65% of the vote last time. He doesn't really need to do much.
In fact, Peterson says it's probably better for King to do little.
The more attention he draws to the race, the more that probably helps his challenger than it helps him.
Peterson says that's because if King were more engaged in the race, Weaver's message would get out more. While it can seem that incumbents get a free pass for re-election, Peterson says it's not just the fact of them already being in office. It's how they got there.
They won last time, and they won last time in part because they're a good fit for their district. King is a really good fit for his district.
And that was in evidence at the Nevada event. Voter Charlene Jarbo of rural Fernald sees King as honest and straightforward. She says he advocates for her beliefs in Washington. For example, regarding immigration, she doesn't want refugees resettled here.
Keep the people from coming in. Do not bring in the people from Syria.
King has come under fire nationally for his remarks about not wanting Syrian refugees to come here and for claiming the superiority of people descended from white Europeans. But while Peterson sees King's re-election as inevitable, that doesn't mean the 4th District will go all in for Republicans.
For Steve King, the difference between 65 and 60 is trivial. But when it comes to aggregating up to the statewide vote, the difference between 65% in the 4th and 60% in the 4th could be pivotal.
In other words, even if Democrats in the 4th can't get Kim Weaver elected, they could make a difference in which way Iowa's 6 electoral votes go in the presidential race. In Story County, I'm Amy Mayer, Iowa Public Radio News.
Election season, Ben Kiefer talked with two professors from our team of political analysts. Hans Hassel of Cornell College, and Justin Holmes of the University of Northern Iowa. Here they are on River to River.
Let me share with you some words from famed election prognosticator Nate Silver, writing in a new article about undecided voters. Quote, about 15% of the electorate isn't yet committed to Clinton or Trump, as compared to just 5% who weren't committed to Obama or Romney at this point in 2012. There's an interesting point in itself. That's one of the reasons, writes Nate Silver, why our models still give Trump an outside chance at victory. In theory, with Clinton at 46% of the vote, Trump could beat her by winning almost all of the undecided and third-party voters. He also throws in practice, there's no indication that these voters have Trump as their second choice. But still, Justin, a relatively large number of undecided voters.
Which I find kind of shocking at this point, honestly. You know, in a typical election, you have two candidates that are representing the mainstream of their party, and they represent different perspectives on things, but they're not. It's not the kind of choice that you have now. You know, it's just such a stark difference between the two candidates on so many levels. It really surprises me. And it is, I think, you know, Nate Silver's absolutely right here. A big unknown is what are these folks going to do? You know, these undecideds. You know, I would suspect that they would probably break about 50-50, but you never know. Certainly it's possible that people are staying undecided because they're embarrassed about their choice of either candidate. It could be that they truly are undecided. Could be that they're, you know, just frustrated and won't show up at all is another possibility. But we just won't know until the voting, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Also, Iowa in a toss-up column here, certainly something like 15% we estimate, Hans, of undecided voters right here in our state.
Yeah, I think that this is actually a really good indication of our democracy, right? We've got two candidates that most individuals would be hesitant to support. And to me, that reassures me that this is not just about party identification, right? We're always concerned that voters are not learning from campaigns, that they're not picking up information, that they're just voting based on party identification. This is a concern that voters are not informed enough to make a good choice. And the fact that there are so many undecided voters, to me, suggests that this is actually a good thing, that voters, right, this gives me reassurance in our democracy that people are really weighing these decisions and they're not just going with their party identification. And I think that that's actually a good thing that we see two candidates that are generally viewed as not particularly great candidates for their party. And we see a lot of these undecided voters. You have lots of Democrats who were unsatisfied with Clinton. You have lots of Republicans that were unsatisfied with Trump. And so the fact that we have so many undecided voters, I think, is a very good sign for our democratic process.
Well, Hans and Justin, we've been keeping touch with a number of Iowa voters during this campaign. One of them, Dan Durant, is a financial advisor from West Des Moines. Due to his work, he couldn't join us live. But listen to what he has to say, because he's been struggling through the primary, the caucuses, into the present day. I spoke with him earlier today because he couldn't join us due to his work. Hello, Dan.
Hi, Ben. How are you today?
I'm doing fine. Now, if we're remembering right, you were undecided during the Iowa caucuses, eventually caucused for John Kasich. You continue to be undecided after Kasich dropped out. And last time we spoke, which I believe was the end of September, you said you were leaning Trump. Are you still supporting Donald Trump?
I am not.
Why not?
Because I find him to be unprincipled, and I don't see him as a viable candidate for the White House.
Mm-hmm. You support?
He's not a solution.
You supported him at one point. What was the tipping point for you that made you not be able to support him?
I kept looking for signs in Donald Trump that he would show some sort of maturity in the political process. Now, granted, he's a neophyte early on, but at some point you start to show presidential characteristics. And what I find is that he continues to go down this rabbit hole of personal attacks, whether it's former Miss Americas or Miss USAs. The debates themselves have devolved into this personal attack on each other, where the two candidates hurl insults. And it's gotten to the point where I can't support him anymore.
So it sounds like for you, this campaign has really been a referendum on Donald Trump or the other candidates, so Hillary Clinton's fitness to be president in your mind.
That's exactly it. It seems to me that no matter who wins, the next 4 years we're going to spend being either ashamed or embarrassed by whatever happens in the White House. And so I've decided that I'm going to vote for Gary Johnson.
The Libertarian candidate. Why?
Yeah. Well, first of all, he's actually run a state. He's been a governor of New Mexico, 2 terms, successful governor of New Mexico. So he has the administrative experience that I'm looking for in a presidential candidate anyway. And he just I haven't seen any of these signs of character weakness. I didn't say he's the perfect candidate, but he's the most qualified candidate.
Mm-hmm. Do you think he has a realistic chance?
No, but I have to vote for the candidate that I think is the most qualified and will do the best job running the country.
Mm-hmm. Are you locked into this decision, or do you think it may change again in the coming days before November 8th, or perhaps you've already voted? We have early voting now for several weeks in Iowa.
No, the only thing that could change my position would be if Donald Trump dropped out of the race and Mike Pence took the top of the ticket. That would be the only thing that could change my opinion at this point.
What is your sense, Dan, living in West Des Moines, about how people you know in West Des Moines are making up their minds as Election Day draws near? Are there others you know in such a quandary as to who to support?
Everybody I talk to is the same. This is a cultural, it's endemic to our society right now. I think people are just fed up. They're fed up with the personal attacks. They're fed up with the negativity, the constant trash talking. And they would love to have seen a candidate that was really above it all.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me out of 18 Republican candidates and 5 Democratic candidates, we ended up with the 2 worst.
If Hillary Clinton is elected president, if the polls are correct, the aggregate of polls are proved to be correct, will you see her as your president? Some across the country are saying, well, there's fraud or rigged elections in one way or another, however you interpret that.
As far as I'm concerned, she won fair and square because the Republicans ran the weakest candidate in the field. Any other of the Republican candidates except for Ted Cruz, in my view, would be up 20 points in the polls right now.
Are you worried at all that the election is rigged in the sense that Donald Trump has repeatedly said that there could be widespread voter fraud? Do you have confidence in our election system?
I do, and I think one of the things that concerns me about Donald Trump is that rather than address the weakness of his campaign and his candidacy, he's looking to make excuses for a poor showing at the polls. That's a lack of maturity.
Okay, Dan Durant, thanks again for letting us check in with you. Dan Durant of West Des Moines, we appreciate it.
Thank you, Ben.
Okay, Dan Durant recorded earlier today. He couldn't join us live because of his work, a financial advisor from West Des Moines. We've been speaking with him on a number of occasions. Now back to live Justin Holmes and Hans Hassel. Justin, so much in there, but pick a point there that really jumped out at you, because Dan is struggling. You can hear it in his voice and the points that he makes.
Yeah, you know, I think Dan is sort of your nightmare Republican scenario in a lot of ways. You know, he's somebody who sounds, you know, very up on politics, you know, clearly pretty engaged in Republican politics. If he went to the caucus, we know those people tend to be, you know, more partisan. And, you know, even he's struggling. And I think this typifies a lot of the problem that Trump is having, is that, you know, you have people like this who would probably vote for any other Republican, and they just can't bring themselves to do it. You know, they're not willing to vote for Clinton, of course. But, you know, ultimately that third party vote is one off the Republican pile and just puts them, you know, that much further behind. So I think, you know, I have a lot of people in my family that are, frankly, in a similar position to Dan. And I know, you know, a lot of them are struggling. And it sort of typifies a real frustration with the politics of the moment.
Okay, Hans.
What did you hear in there that piqued your interest?
One of the things that Dan mentioned was this: the conversations that he's had with friends and acquaintances. And I think you asked him a question, right? Do you feel like you're the only one struggling with this? And he said, no, right? Everyone I talk to feels the same way. And I think that that's really representative about how we think about politics, is that politics is largely dependent upon our social network, who we talk to, who we engage with. And so, right, Dan's experience suggests that it's not just Dan, right? Just as Justin said, it's mm-hmm. Justin's had other people in his family that are dealing with this. So I think that Dan in this situation is, right, one of a larger demographic that really is turned off by the Republican nominee, right? His education and his background suggests that he's part of this college-educated white group of voters that – in the past have really been strongly Republican voters, and are they going to – right? Are they shifting away from the Republican Party, or is this, you know, just an aspect of Donald Trump, and that we'll see a return of this group to the Republican fold in coming elections? But I mean, I think that's what's really interesting is it's not just Dan here that's dealing with this. It's the social network that he's a part of. It's that demographic that Trump is really struggling with, that normally would vote, you know, would vote consistently Republican, and that's just not the case here.
Hans Hassel is with us of Cornell College in Mount Vernon. Justin Holmes of the University of Northern Iowa, Politics Wednesday. Join our discussion. If you, too, are still struggling with which presidential candidate to get will get your support, share your thoughts. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. You can email us with your quandary, if that's what it is, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Or find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook. We've been keeping in touch with a number of Iowa voters. Dan Durant was one of them. Another one is Margaret Guth. She joins us live, clerk in the Iowa Senate from North Central Iowa. Margaret, are you there?
Yes. Hello.
Hi.
Glad to be here.
Wonderful to have you on the program again. To recount, I believe you caucused for Ted Cruz. We spoke with you in August, I believe, the last time, and you voiced support then for Donald Trump. Does Donald Trump still have your full support?
Yes, he does.
Tell us why.
I am basically voting for the platform of the Republican Party, and so he happens to be the nominee.
Mm-hmm. So your thoughts on, since we last spoke, we had the 2005 video of Donald Trump in which he brags about treating women in ways that, frankly, amount to sexual assault. Also following that, allegations made by at least 10 women that he touched them in inappropriate ways. Did that jar your decision to, or make you think again about your decision to vote for Trump?
It's disappointing. But nobody's talking about President Clinton and all his escapades. And so, you know, I'm like, so maybe he did the missteps. And yes, I would rather that we had a different nominee. Mm-hmm. But I'm still going to stay behind the Republican platform. And he represents that the best that we can in the kind of culture that we're at.
You mentioned Bill Clinton, of course, but his name is not on the ballot.
No, but his wife is.
Okay, so she's associated with him, and that makes
very much
that makes it a problem for you.
Huge, ever since they were first in the White House.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What issues most concern you?
Right now, I would like to, because we have such a huge problem with life being protected, I really continue to want to see someone that protects life from the beginning to the end.
Mm-hmm. So would you characterize yourself as a single issue voter on abortion?
No, I don't. I really actually care about that. It really affects every other issue that we have to deal with. It really does. It trickles down.
Back to what we've learned about Donald Trump through that video and the women coming forth with allegations. Have you had a conversation with other voters in your social circle, friends, acquaintances, about his words, his behavior toward women?
Not particularly, like what Dan Durant talked about. But I just hear commenting, so we're not actively talking about it.
Mm-hmm. I wonder what you think of Dan's conclusion that he can no longer support Donald Trump. I think because he said simply for a lack of maturity. You can't see that person as a preteness, so sort of a fitness for president test.
Right. I look at this as Donald Trump comes from a totally different culture, if you please, in New York, and his whole upbringing and everything. Just a little bit that I've read about him, it's like he's coming from a different culture, and we're not used to that. So, yes, I don't agree with everything. I'm not condoning things, but I keep that in perspective. And he is slowly changing as he begins to realize what this role of being a president is all about. But you're never going to take that completely out of him, you know, the culture that he grew up with.
Mm-hmm. And your view of Hillary Clinton?
As in what?
As a possible next president of the United States, if she is elected, which polls seem to indicate, if the polls are correct, she will be the next president, unless there's something momentous happening in the final 2 weeks of this campaign. How will you see her as your president?
I really have trouble seeing her as a president. I really do.
Why?
Because there's so much behind her and all the trail of different scandals and different kinds of things that you just don't see that with Donald Trump. You didn't see that with a lot of the other candidates either. And she is just rife with that. I mean, she's full up to the gills of all kinds of criminal activity that even if there isn't anything right now, you know, planned or I mean, at least there's still a lot of doubt behind her.
Okay, Margaret Guth, with your view from Des Moines, well, from North Central Iowa, thank you for giving us your view and the reason that you're still supporting Donald Trump. Margaret, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's check back in. Hans, what are you hearing there? A very different story. Someone who finds himself with Trump. She says she supports the party platform of the GOP. Trump, rather an outsider in his own party. What did you find interesting about Margaret's reasoning there?
Well, I think that that's a very strong motivation. She's motivated by party identification and party identification and all that that encompasses, the issues, the content, the policy proposals of the Republican ticket. And I think that people that vote vote their party, even when perhaps their candidate is not their ideal candidate, as you see, you know, many Republicans doing and many Democrats doing, say, you know, he's not my preferred option, but he's better than the alternative. And this is what we call strategic voting, right? Rather than voting sincerely on their sincere preferences, which may be Evan McMullen or a Gary Johnson or a Jill Stein or, you know, some other candidate that's out there. They say, right, who is actually viable here? Who's likely to win? And which of these people can I tolerate the most out of these two viable candidates? And so what you get is a bunch of people who are voting strategically. And that, to me, that's what sounds like what's going on here. She's not particularly wild about Donald Trump and some of the things that he's done, but she's sure as a heck a lot better than the Hillary Clinton is. And I think that that's really what motivates a lot of people to stick with their party lines, is that they're viewing these two options as the two viable options. And given that set of alternatives, that's what they're going to go with.
Donald Trump's campaign is now having to defend his decision to spend the precious campaign time he has left, 12 days away from the election. In the final days, less than 2 weeks ago, he's taking a break from full campaigning to formally open a new hotel in Washington today. Yesterday, a visit to another of Trump's properties, the Doral Golf Course outside Miami. Meanwhile, I think Mike Pence out in Utah today. Out in Utah, a state which hasn't backed a Democrat for over 50 years. Hans, mm-hmm. What do you make of this travel schedule and the priorities with some of his business promotion mixed in?
No, Trump has not been a typical politician throughout this.
Newsflash. Newsflash.
Has not been a typical politician throughout this campaign. And I think that he is banking on any news being better than the news that he's currently getting in a lot of these issues. I mean, I was talking with teaching this term, a class on campaigns and elections, and we were talking about the discussion about the third debate where Trump basically said, I'm not going to necessarily concede the election, and I'm not going to make a concession speech or something along those lines. And my students were saying, why are they doing this? Right? Why in the world is he going to make this statement? This is going to get all the news coverage and ruin the very good first 30 minutes of the debate. And we came to the conclusion that that's a much better news topic for news to cover for him than the sexual assault accusations, right? If we have to pick a line of cleavage or something that the media is going to cover, they'd much rather talk about vote rigging than they would talk about sexual assault. And so I think that what this is that he's constantly he knows how to get the media to focus on things that are going to be as beneficial to him as possible. And I think that this is what really that's about. This is about drawing media attention away from some of the things that may matter or may be more detrimental to him. And and towards his more eccentric campaign behaviors, which is going to highlight his his business acumen, and that's going to really drive that story.
But I wonder if we're giving him too much of the benefit of the doubt. Okay, here he has this week. We heard this week he has some ammo in his pouch. What is it? Obamacare, Affordable Care Act premiums slated to rise by an average of 25%. That is some solid information that he should be able to make some hay out of. At a campaign event in his Miami area golf resort yesterday, Trump blamed President Obama's Affordable Care Act legislation for his employees' struggles with health care. Let's listen to a bit of it.
Obamacare has to be repealed and replaced, and it has to be replaced with something much less expensive for the people, and otherwise this country's in even bigger trouble than anybody thought. So we're going to repeal and replace Obamacare. And I can say all of my employees are having a tremendous problem with Obamacare. You folks, this is another group. Is that a correct statement? I mean, you look at what they're going through. What they're going through with their health care is horrible because of Obamacare.
Okay, so Trump's statement, though, that his employees that you just heard struggle with Obamacare was later very quickly corrected by his general manager, David Fader, as well as corrected by Trump himself. Because Trump's employees are on private insurance. They don't rely on Obamacare. Hans, I mean, you said you're saying he's – I mean, there he has it. His ammo is in his pouch. He misfires. Can you read it any other way?
I think that he's not very smart in what he says, but I think he's smart in what he's doing. I mean, I think that – you talk about what the media is going to cover. They're going to cover scandals, wins, announcements, and gaffes generally, right? They're often not going to get into the nuance of policy discussions. They're not going to get in the nuance of trying to frame the election of one choice or another, right? The big things that the media talks about are these four things: scandals, wins, announcements, gaffes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that he's saying, well, if I have to pick something that they're going to cover, I'm going to at least pick a scandal that's going to highlight something that I'm really good at.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I am reading too much. Maybe he's just a bad politician in terms of what he's doing. But to me, I see Trump manipulate the media in terms of what they're choosing to cover. Right? We see this all throughout we saw this all throughout the primaries. And so he may not be a great politician, but one thing that I think that he really does understand is understand how to use the media to his advantage. And I view this trip to his businesses instead of campaigning really is something that I view this as a strategic decision as about what he wants the media to cover right now.
Mm-hmm. Justin, do you see it differently at all?
I've always wondered about applying the word strategic to Trump in general, and I'm truly torn on this. You know, he does things that are completely atypical, and I think Hans has a good point on some of this, on all of that. I will say with the Obamacare thing, a lot of this really for me typifies that he's very much playing to his base. This is a big, big taboo topic with Republicans. It's the kind of thing that shores them back up. It's pretty clear listening to him talk. He doesn't have the first idea of what Obamacare is or how it works or any of that. But frankly, neither do a lot of Americans. So it's enough to just say Obamacare bad over and over again. And that's what people hear, and that's the message that they get. And that does him, some help, at least uniting perhaps some of those reluctant Republicans that are peeling off. I don't think it picks up any moderates and certainly won't peel off Democrats.
Mm-hmm. Before the election, any predictions? We have predictions out there in the media all the way from a Clinton landslide slide to a modest Clinton majority to a Clinton nail biter to a shocking Trump victory, shocking because it would defy all the polls for sure. Any predictions?
I think a modest Clinton victory is what we'll probably see, probably a little bit larger than it was in 2012. I mean, I think that the interesting thing, like I said at the beginning of the show, is not necessarily the outcome, which I think is pretty clear to most people. But in the effects of this election going forward, and as we were just talking about the Senate, are we going to see an uptick in split ticket voting? Right? Are we going to see more people voting Democrat at the top of the ticket and Republican down ballot, or vice versa? And that's the interesting thing to me going forward.
Mm-hmm. Will you jump on board with that, Justin? A modest Clinton victory, if you had to predict today?
Yeah, I mean, if nothing changes from today, and I don't see anything on the horizon that would, I'd guess about a 6 or 7 point Clinton victory and a fairly sizable victory in the Electoral College. And, you know, I agree with Hans wholeheartedly. I mean, what's interesting about this is what comes next, in particular, what's the future of the Republican Party, you know, after presumably three elections where they lose presidential elections. They've already done soul searching after the last two and largely not taken some pretty good advice that they've been given, you know, this time around. But I think, you know, after you lose that many elections in a row, you know, the Democrats went through this in the past and certainly recalibrated their party. It'll be interesting to see if the Republicans are able to do the same.
Justin Holmes is an assistant professor at the University of Northern Iowa, and Hans Hassel is an assistant professor of politics at Cornell College. They talked with Ben Kiefer on River to River. You can tune in for live election night coverage from NPR and IPR November 8th on Iowa Public Radio's news stations, beginning at 7 p.m. We'll also be recapping the elections in Des Moines and Cedar Rapids on the evening of November 10th. Stay with us. This election has been quite remarkable, entertaining to say the least, and we're all excited to see what happens. I can't wait for our future generations to read about it in their U.S. government textbooks. I'm Shirley Wong, and this has been The Procrastinator's Politics. And you know, procrastination gets a bad rep, but you know what? I had a great time studying last minute. No apologies. Thanks for listening.